Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Riding with Reagan, From the White House to the Ranch, by John R. Barletta, with Rochelle Schweitzer. Narrated by Christopher Grove. There is nothing better for the inside of a man than the outside of a horse. Ronald Reagan. 1. The bond is forged. I was in what we called the down room in the White House, taking a break with a few other agents, when my shift leader came in to ask if any of us could ride. The down room is a small room near the command post, with a few couches and some hooks on the wall where the agents can hang their jackets. The shift leaders had been asking all the agents the same question: does anyone know how to ride a horse? At first, the question surprised me, but I sheepishly raised my hand. The boss said, "Barletta, you're going to go over to President-elect Reagan's detail out at the ranch next time." I said in response, "Yes, sir." Consisting of approximately 2,000 agents, the U.S. Secret Service is an integrated but layered network. In its sophisticated operations, the Secret Service assigns each division with a specific area of protection. The uniformed division is responsible for the security of the White House and grounds, as well as foreign embassies in the United States. They outfit their command post with equipment such as infrared cameras that monitor all that is going on in or near the White House. They are usually a part of the Secret Service advance team in charge of the magnetometers, dog teams, and counter-sniper teams. The Technical Security Division, TSD, make certain all the electronic systems are in place, including the ground's perimeter alarms. Located in the west wing of the White House, the surprisingly unpretentious Secret Service command post is referred to as W-16. When compared to the uniform division, the equipment is simple: a few television monitors and a switchboard to receive incoming calls. Today, it is much more sophisticated, with the supervisor's offices and plenty of state-of-the-art technology located across the street in the executive office building. In this mammoth operation, everyone has a boss: supervisors, shift leaders, and working agents. On our detail, everyone answered to the shift leader first. The entire Secret Service always faces a huge learning curve during the transition to a new administration. Following the election of a new president, the Presidential Protective Division, PPD, splits the detail between the sitting president and the president-elect, so that some agents can start getting used to the new man's needs and mannerisms. Right from the beginning, President Reagan's detail started accompanying him to his ranch. With the grueling campaign over, the ranch was where he and Mrs. Reagan wanted to go to relax. It soon became apparent that the supervisors at the ranch were having quite a time finding agents to protect the newly elected president while he was riding his horse. Horses are dangerous, and you have to know what you're doing. The rider is handling a big animal, weighing about 1,200 pounds, with incredible strength and jumping and running abilities, and with a brain the size of a walnut. The problems at the ranch began even before anyone mounted a horse. First, no one had any idea how to tie a horse. The president-elect ended up saddling the horses for the agents. Things only got worse once they started riding. President Reagan would ride fast and jump fences. He was really an English equestrian rider. The agents assigned to him did not know how to ride, and they were having trouble keeping up with him. One day, an agent fell off his horse and broke his arm. The president-elect dismounted his horse to take care of the agent. Our chief supervisor at the time rightly said that was not how things should work. The president was not supposed to be giving us aid and comfort. That was what we should be doing for him. After that incident, the detail supervisor called the White House and said, "I have a big problem out here. I need someone who can ride a horse." The supervisor at the White House put out the word to the shift leaders that they needed to find an agent who could really ride. And that's where I came in. To deal with the new security needs at the ranch following Reagan's election, the Secret Service created the Western Protective Division, WPD, which would protect the ranch even when the first couple was not there. In the weeks before the inauguration, agents made a trip to Santa Barbara, California. Members of the Secret Service always fly commercially, unless they are working a shift. Only then do they fly on Air Force One or another government aircraft. In Santa Barbara, the agents used dozens of rental cars that had been brought up from Los Angeles. During the first few months, we drove those rental cars from our hotel in Santa Barbara to the ranch for our 8-hour shifts. But the drive up the winding mountain road was tough, and it wasn't long before sturdier Chevy Suburbans replaced them. For the next 8 years, the Suburbans were workhorses, transporting the agents on those precipitous drives to and from the ranch. The number of agents on duty at the ranch varied, depending on ever-changing circumstances such as the weather and the president's arrivals and departures. In addition to the dog teams outside the perimeter, there could be as many as 54 supplemental agents standing post. The president and I first met in late November 1980, during my first trip to the ranch. On my first morning there, I was standing outside the barn with Jerry Parr, the deputy special agent in charge, when the president-elect approached us on his way to get his horse ready. A path of about 50 steps led from the ranch house to the tack room. Built on a hill, the tack room was in a metal and brick building with two large rooms. In one of the rooms were the president's two jeeps, a tractor, and all the ranch tools, including chainsaws, pole saws, and axes. All the horse equipment was kept inside the second room, where the wall was covered with saddles hanging on racks. Some of the saddles were gifts that the president had received, while others were ones he had used for years. Near the tack room was a workbench attached to the wall, which was used for taking chainsaws apart. The stables were next to the barn, and they were usually empty because the president liked to let his horses run free. Reagan was dressed to go riding. He had on his jodhpurs, one of the three shirts he always wore, and the best English riding boots, brown Dehner three-buckle field boots from Omaha. These boots were from the old school, and few people wear them anymore. The president saw us and said, "Good morning." "Good morning, Mr. President," Jerry responded. "This is Agent John Barletta. He is from the White House detail, and he is going to ride with you today." A quiet, soft-spoken, intelligent man, Jerry looked like Walter Matthau. All the shift members liked him, and the respect for him was immense. He was highly experienced and really knew his job. The president nodded and smiled, but you could tell by the look in his eyes that he was skeptical. "Oh, no," he was thinking, "not another one that I'm going to have to babysit. I won't be able to do what I want because these guys can't ride." My boss knew nothing about horseback riding, and he had never seen me ride either. Still, Jerry was anxious to give me a try. Before we went into the tack room, he gave me explicit instructions on how to handle the president-elect and his requests while riding with him. "John, the president may ask you if it's all right for him to do something while riding. Always tell him that he can do whatever he wants to do and that you will keep up with him." "Mr. Parr," I reminded him, "you've never seen me on a horse. You don't even know if I can ride or not." Jerry shot back, "You told me you could." When we entered the barn, the president was expecting to gather his tack, saddle, bridle, halter, and cleaning gear. There were usually 6 horses at the ranch. President Reagan was a very particular rider, and he knew just how he wanted the slipknot for his horse tied. He also wanted his saddle positioned and secured in just a certain way. The horse's shape determines the exact placement of the saddle, and the front of the saddle needs to fit over his withers, the place where the neck comes into the shoulder of the horse. Some horses do not have good withers, making it extremely difficult to secure a saddle on them. When you tighten the saddle, it needs to be done just right. If it's too tight, the horse will have difficulty breathing, and if it's not tight enough, it will come loose while you are riding. Cinching a saddle properly takes some practice. The president usually got his own horse ready. For For the most part, good riders want to saddle their own horses. But on my first morning there, I wanted everything just right. So I had tacked up his horse before he got to the barn. I followed him to his horse, and I could tell he was surprised that the horse was ready. I had groomed the horse, picked his feet, put his halter on, lifted his stirrups, and placed the saddle on securely. Of course, I was nervous as he started looking his horse over. Soon, I heard him say, "Now, John, I want to show you a couple of things. I like to tie my horses this way." But when he looked at the slipknot, he realized that I knew how to do that. "Oh, I see you've done that before." Then he talked about the way the saddles are positioned. "Now, John, my saddle..." "Oh, I see you've done that before, too." When he lifted one of the horse's hooves to clean it, and saw that it had already been done, he just said, "Oh, my, my." Following a few such observations by the president, I could see that he had a little bit more trust in me. But after all he had seen over the past few weeks, he was still leery. Ready to go, we mounted our horses and started walking them. The president rode a big black thoroughbred mare that he had raised himself. Since the Secret Service had not obtained any of its own horses yet, I rode one of the president's, Gualianco, a beautiful gray. The weather that morning was bright and seasonable. It is usually 75 degrees and sunny in Santa Barbara in November, but the weather at the ranch can be more variable. On that morning, it was close to perfect. As we rode toward the tiny adobe ranch house, painted white with a red Spanish-tiled roof, it looked as if it was just a small part of a painting under the vast blue sky. The land was flat where the house was built, but from that spot there was a panoramic view of the mountain range and the groves of imposing oak trees. As we passed the house and entered the pasture, the president asked, "Can we pick up the pace and trot?" "Mr. President," I said, "you can do anything you want." We started trotting. It was a test. If I could not have kept up, he probably would have stopped, as he had done in the past with the other agents. But I stayed right with him, and soon we were in the field. The grass was swaying, and the field looked like a green ocean. We continued trotting, and before I knew it, we were talking. He started calling me John right away. Although mindful of my purpose in riding with the president, I was at ease with him, and there were moments when I almost forgot that this was our first ride together. If you're not a good rider, your butt slaps the saddle as soon as you start trotting. The president kept watching me closely, and he noticed that I wasn't slapping the saddle. He looked at me and smiled. When we reached a fence, we needed to open the gate. Along the path we were riding on, the gates had been left closed but unlocked. Once the ride was over, however, they were again secured by a combination lock. It is dangerous to lean over the horse and undo the latch. Not wanting me to have to open it, the president leaned right over his horse and said, "John, I'll get it." "No, Mr. President, I will get that for you." Instead of leaning over the horse, I sidestepped my horse up to the gate and undid the latch. Again he looked at me, but this time he gave me one of those big Irish smiles that goes right through you. After I had opened the gate, and we had ridden through it, he asked me, "John, do you want me to close the gate?" "No, Mr. President," I said. "There is a vehicle full of agents behind us. We need to leave it open. They will close the gate." Most of the ground at the ranch is hard and rocky. Once you get beyond the first gate, there is a nice, soft stretch across the meadow that goes down for about a mile before you get to the well. Here, the president wanted to run. "John, do you mind if we do a collected canter?" he asked, the reins firmly in his hands. "Mr. President," I answered, "you can do anything you want." When you do a collected canter, the horse is moving out, but not in a full run. When you canter, a moderate gallop, each horse usually tries to compete with the other. That's much harder than it looks. If you don't know what you're doing, the horse will run away with you. We started cantering, and the horses were running side by side. Anybody who rides knows how difficult that is to do. It's extremely unusual for the horses to remain next to each other. Our horses, though, matched strides, equal with each other. We kept the horses at the same stride for about 15 minutes until we got to the well. The president raised his hand and said, "Whoa!" just like someone in the cavalry would say it. From the well, he liked to turn off into the brush, which was about 2 miles from where we started. There was a new well constructed by the U.S. Navy Seabees. The older well on the president's property was called the Beehive, and it provided the water for the ranch. After Reagan was elected president, big changes were needed to accommodate the additional people working there. No longer would just the Reagans and maybe a few friends and family be at the ranch. Instead, there could be 175 people at any one time. There were agents, special officers, Secret Service uniformed division dog teams, counter-sniper teams, and so on. To help secure the place, 29 Secret Service vehicles were kept on the property. They had to build a helicopter pad for Marine One and a hangar to store it in. In addition, a plane was on site that nobody knew about, nor would they, unless it was needed. It is hard to imagine that all of this was going on when you see the pictures of the president out for his private, peaceful rides on the trails. The agents did all they could to shelter the first couple from intrusions, so that they could enjoy their time alone. Trees and shrubs were planted to cover many of the buildings, giving them a sense of privacy. The brush area past the well was rocky and full of trees, and the trails were hidden by vegetation, including madrona trees, oaks, and greasewood. Looking down into the valley, you felt that you were on top of the world as you took in the moss-covered rocks, grand oak trees, and patches of twisted vines and roots. For the president, it was almost a sacred area, a place of complete solace from huge demands and decisions. While riding here, we saw many gophers scurrying around. It seemed like there were millions of them. People who love horses hate gophers, since they not only ruin the vegetation, but they make holes that could cause a horse to break a leg if he steps into one. 8 years later, I found out how dangerous those could be. We rode together for another 2 hours on these narrow, roaming trails. The president didn't say a word, and I wouldn't think of starting a conversation unless I had to inform him of something. I would always wait to speak until after he'd spoken to me. I knew my place and didn't want to take advantage of my position. Once we had entered the brush area, we lost the vehicle carrying the other agents. The agents kept calling me, wanting to know how we were doing and what was going on. After a number of these calls, I told them to reduce the radio traffic unless necessary, so that I could concentrate. When we arrived back at the house, we went to the hitching post where Jerry was watching for us. He looked worried, his brow all crinkled up, and he waited for the president to get off his horse so he could ask him a question. The president always dismounted his horse by throwing his right leg over the saddle and jumping down, which is extremely dangerous. Most people dismount by throwing their right leg over the horse's rump, but I can never talk him out of it. He did it from day one. While the president was tying up his horse to the hitching post, Jerry asked him, "How did it go, Mr. President? How was your ride?" President Reagan first looked at me and then turned back to my boss. "Well, you finally got me a good one," he said. 2. The Unlikeliest of Friends. That first ride was the beginning of a special relationship that was forged through not only a love for horses, but the many years we spent riding over the trails alone. My boss made it clear to me on that sunny November morning that from then on, I had to be prepared to come out to the ranch every time the president did, and I would go with him anywhere else he was going to ride. There were things about Ronald Reagan I already knew I liked. The first time I saw him and heard him speak was on October 28, 1980, in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Bond Court Hotel. For members of the Secret Service, a presidential campaign always presents challenges and changes. After Robert Kennedy was assassinated in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California, in 1968, Congress decreed that the Secret Service must cover any viable candidate running for president. Five individuals from different areas of the government determine viability. Once a candidate is deemed viable, he or she starts to have the aura of the presidency, because it's a lot bigger deal if a candidate shows up with a Secret Service entourage than if they just ride up in a taxi. I was on the detail covering President Carter at one of the debates, and I was impressed by the way Reagan handled himself. I remember how much I liked it when he kept saying, "Well, there you go again." And then there was the, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" line. Of course we weren't, with 57 hostages in Iran and 21% interest rates. After that debate, I remember hearing one of President Carter's aides tell him, "Mr. President, you did a great job." "I did not," was all he said in response. Everyone, including President Carter, knew Reagan had eaten him up. Those unforgettable lines from the debates were only the first of many endearing things I would hear from Reagan. He was likable from the beginning, and he really knew how to communicate. His vision for America was optimistic. I had previously covered both President Ford's son Michael and his wife Gail, and then President Carter. During those years, the country was struggling, and consequently many Americans were pessimistic about the future. Now there would be a new man in the White House. His ideas were hopeful. Things could be good again, and there were opportunities for everyone. As we learned over the years, those were not just his ideas, but beliefs he held dearly. Because of his upbringing, the glitz of Hollywood and the power of the White House did not reveal much about the man I came to know. Reagan valued decency and hard work, and found respite in the simple pleasures of life. Reagan's core came from his mother, Nell Reagan. As I got to know him, it became clear that his mother ran the house when he was growing up. Jack Reagan, his father, was an alcoholic who worked as a shoe salesman, most of the time holding small jobs while always on the search for his pot of gold. The family spent years bouncing around Illinois, and as a boy, Reagan never lived in a house that his family owned. Instead, he grew up in apartments above a bank and later a shoe store, as well as various rental homes along the way. Before reaching his teen years, he lived in 5 different towns and 12 rented apartments or houses. He was often the new kid on the block, seeking comfort from the difficulties all those childhood disruptions must have caused. He gravitated more to his mother, who was his anchor. His mother set all the rules and made all the critical decisions for her boys. When Reagan became a father, he would tell his children to go to their mother when they had a problem or a difficult question, because that is how he had seen it done. Clearly, his mother taught him the values for which he came to be admired: being down to earth, being idealistic, and telling it like it is. He got all that from Nell Reagan. His father, who could be cynical, had very little influence on him, and his brother Neil, or Moon Reagan, had even less influence on him. He used to call Neil the one-match kid because he was a chain-smoker. Neil would light a cigarette, and then before that cigarette would go out, he'd use it to light another one, chain-smoking all day. To Reagan, that habit was a mystery. Early on in our relationship, the president put me at ease. While riding our horses, I was always conscious of my duty to protect him. Still, on those early rides, I was surprised by how disarming and transparent he was with me. Once, after we had been riding for some time in silence, he asked me, "John, you know the best job I ever had?" I thought I knew the answer to that one, so I immediately answered, "Yes, sir, being president." "No," he replied, "I was a dishwasher in a girl's sorority." As he explained it, he could stand around all those pretty girls and get paid for it. In fall 1928, just a year before the Depression, Reagan left Dixon, Illinois to enroll in Eureka College. A poor young man, it was extremely difficult for him not only to get into school, but then to pay for it once he was there. He worked hard, though, taking side jobs. His work ethic, which he inherited from his mother, ran deep. While still living in Illinois, he also worked as a salesman at a sporting goods store. He liked that job, and he told me that at one time he thought that was what he would do for a living. Reagan's humble upbringing kept him modest throughout his life. When he combined his work ethic with his natural good looks and charm, it didn't take him long to land some starring roles in Hollywood. However, he didn't have an ego. I never heard him say, "I can do that because I'm President of the United States." While he was a part of Hollywood and the whole system, it never became a big part of him. Anyone who has watched his movies can see how his plain mannerisms came out on the screen, just as they did in his politics. People wanted to sit and listen to him. His actions and choices were unlike many of the other stars and climbers around him. Countless Hollywood marriages are broken up because the success of one partner has bruised the other's ego. But not Reagan. He ended up divorced from Jane Wyman because she'd just won an Oscar for her performance in Johnny Belinda, while he was busy making B-movies. He didn't care, but obviously she did, and Wyman filed for the divorce. That devastated him, and he never talked about it later in life. President Reagan never put on airs. He had a remarkable ability to be just as comfortable with the person cutting his hair as he was with actor Charlton Heston, who was one of his very good friends from their days in the Screen Actors Guild. Once, when we were riding along a trail, he started to tell me about Santa Fe Trail, a movie he had made with Errol Flynn in 1940. I'd always been curious about Flynn, and while I would never have been the one to initiate a conversation like this one with him, I seized the opportunity to ask the president a question about the movie star. Are all the stories about his womanizing true? "John," he said, "I went out with him for 3 nights and I couldn't keep up with him. He'd be up all night, and then on the set the next day, his lines all memorized and ready to go, looking good. He was a true professional." The president was good-looking, and naturally had many women after him, so I've been told. Yet he never would have bragged about it. I asked him, "I understand you were sought after, too." "Well, I guess a little bit," he said, and smiled. While he wouldn't elaborate, his friends sure told me. He was just too humble to brag. The president was also graceful and a good, slow dancer, but he wasn't musical. I remember him singing in church once, and you wouldn't want him in the choir. I never saw any records around or heard any music on his radio. I once asked him if he wanted the radio on in the limousine, and he said, "No." I later asked him one or two more times, and then I dropped it. When he said no, that was exactly what he meant. As I got to know the president better, his honesty impressed me greatly. Although in many ways he was smooth and always seemed a bit like a Hollywood leading man, he was forthright. That puzzled his critics. Some people say he wasn't the smartest president. Maybe he wasn't. But he knew his facts. His memory was phenomenal. He would read the scripts for the promotional video shot at his office in Century City after his presidency, and he would always get them in one take. The producers and the directors couldn't believe it. I remember one time they asked him, "Okay, Mr. President, can we do it again?" "Why? Did I do something wrong?" "No, no, it was great." "Then why are we going to do it again?" he asked. They looked at each other for reassurance. Then someone would say, "Well, I guess we don't have to do it again." "Yeah, that's perfect." Some of the president's friends called him One-Shot Reagan. Even more than knowing his facts, he knew and understood people and human nature. Early on, he came to appreciate the fact that I knew my limitations, and everyone has plenty of them. I had only been to the ranch a few times when an incident took place. It illustrated to me just how well he understood that pride was one of the worst human vanities. One morning, a military aide had a problem with his horse, so the president let him use one of his. Seeing that the aide was having a few problems readying the horse, I walked over to him and asked, "Sir, can I help you with your horse?" He looked at me and answered, "I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. I've been riding horses for years." I continued to watch him for a few more moments and saw that he was still struggling. "Okay, fine," I said as I walked away. Next, the president came up. He was on his way to get Mrs. Reagan's horse, No Strings, which was always the first part of his routine. He got the saddle and the grooming equipment, and then started brushing her horse.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?